Welcome to Real Geeks. I am Crash and Burn, and with me, as always, is Mike Montgomery.
Nothing like chronicling the films of my past with a Van Damme movie that my initial desire to see it had actually had nothing to do with Jean-Claude Van Damme.
That's a very odd way of approaching a Van Damme film, because I very distinctly remember the first Jean-Claude Van Damme movie I ever saw, Universal Soldier, was because, hey, isn't that Jean-Claude Van Damme? Also, zombie soldiers, we're not watching that today. No, unfortunately, I don't get my way, but we do get something of interest, something of note, something. I don't know what to make of this film, and it's really interesting.
As I said before, this is the other Jean-Claude Van Damme franchise that he was doing over and over and over.
Yeah, and I kind of have a lot of appreciation for this one being like, all right, if the franchise that he does over and over and over again is a cup of coffee that gets weaker and weaker as it goes ahead, this, for some reason, they're like, or maybe you would like a spot of tea? It's the only way to really, really explain it. This is Jean-Claude Van Damme's The Quest!
Where did you learn to fight like that?
It was long ago. On the run from the law.
Check the cargo.
He's here somewhere. Move it.
Captured by gunrunners.
A story. You work for us. Put him in chains.
Who the hell is that?
What's your name, son?
Christopher Dubois.
Mine's Dobbs. Your Dobbs.
Hurry it up, man.
Sold into slavery.
Chris Dubois, the United States of America, the best fighter I've ever seen.
Be ready at all times. You will learn that.
He wouldn't give up until he found a way to win back his honor.
The best fighters will meet to compete in the Lost City for a dragon made of solid gold.
I tell you what, you get us to the Lost City, and I'll make sure that we come back with the gold.
City, we greet our first heroes.
I was driven to look up if this film was for some fucking reason based on a true story, because its commitment to the era it's from is too weirdly specific, and the character choices are like, okay, why is this here? It can only make sense if this was like a biography, and if for some reason the other films in this genre, the Bloodsport genre, I suppose, is the only way to say it's not even a series, it's a genre unto itself, because it's beat by beat. The only thing that makes this really truly make sense is if that entire genre was taken from someone's real life, and this is like that person's biography. This entire film, speaking of like genres of fight films, there's a genre of fight film in Hong Kong that is essentially Ip Man related people who are in the orbit of Ip Man, and so that's like a good 70 years of potential, and you end up having like characters who appeared in like Ip Man 4 get their own spinoff, and then a character who appears in that spinoff gets their own spinoff. This feels like an Ip Man spinoff. Like at some point in like Ip Man 1, he fought Jean-Claude Van Damme's character. Like when he was out training on Mutai Island or some shit.
Yeah.
And then this is the resulting like Scorpion King-esque fucking sequel spinoff.
Well, yeah, I could 100% see your logic here, because with its connections to Bloodsport, this is like a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy. So we're about like four generations of photocopies down the line of the quote-unquote true story of Frankie Dukes, who was, of course, the inspiration behind Bloodsport, and also wrote The Quest alongside Van Damme.
Wait, and thus I must assume that the time period this movie takes place in is, like, okay, in some bizarre fit of reality, Bloodsport is the realistic one, and The Quest, despite all its historical elements, is complete fucking bullshit. Okay, good to know. Good to approach this that way, because there's a lot of little detail. Like, I wish that a more modern sensibility for tying films together existed, and this intentionally was like, it's the origin of Bloodsport, or it's the origin of this guy that was super fucking old in Bloodsport. Tying it together in some direct way so that, yes, you're making the same movie, but I am trying to build a larger universe in history, that would have been cool, that would have been interesting. Why is he a fucking clown at the beginning? I understand why. It's very interesting character work. He's like a New York Fagin who collects anything these orphans steal and then redistributes it so that everyone can eat and stuff. It's like Newsies and Oliver Twist, but he's dressed like a clown, oddly, specifically like the clown Roger Moore was dressed like in a certain James Bond movie. Just putting that out there, this film is filled with fucking clowns. And then he's given an even deeper backstory about how, like, his family was rich, but his mom died before, like, she could come to America and, like, bring the inheritance. And so, there's so much going on that has fucking nothing to do with the rest of the film.
No.
Nothing. The MacGuffin, the golden goddamn dragon, has nothing to do with the rest of the fucking film. The bar in which old man Jean-Claude enters, and like the entire film is technically set in because he's telling a story to the bartender. It has nothing to do with anything.
All of these things are
set up for deeper stories. And no, fuck that.
No. Also, quick side note, remember, to be precise, it's supposed to be old Jean-Claude Van Damme, because he starts the scene acting like an old man and drops that facade, aside from the extra accent that he's putting on for reasons.
For reasons.
Like, he drops it so fast.
Right? Oh my god, It's so, this child was raised in New York since, like, I don't know, the age of 4, 5, 6, 7, something like that. Young child. Why does he still sound like he is from Belgium?
Okay, now, first of all, this got onto the list for my film history. Like, there's no super elaborate story here. This, like, it was quite simply, this was the first film that I got to see in a theater by myself.
Ah. Okay.
I was 16 and The Quest was coming out and I was dying to go and see this. The entire rest of my family wanted to go and see something else. And obviously, like, they're only making one trip to the theater. So, like, okay, fine. You can go to that one. We're all going to go to this other one. And This was also roughly the time that I was starting to get into the Bond franchise. And for also for anybody who's thinking, yes, 16 is a little late to be going to the theater for the first time by yourself. It's just, it worked out that way. Don't question it.
Yeah, that's just how it is. I don't even remember the first film I saw at a theater by myself. Like, I'm immediately being like, no, I saw Batman Forever by myself, like with some friends.
Yeah.
Not with family or anything. Oh, that's pushing it way the fuck back now.
But so I saw the trailer of his, like I said, the hook for me had nothing to do with Van Damme, the star of the movie. But this was roughly the period where I was also starting to get into the Bond franchise, but I had gotten into it in the wrong order. So I thought the first James Bond was Roger Moore.
Mm-hmm.
So I see this trailer, I'm going, I get to see Roger Moore in a theater. I'm going to a Roger Moore movie.
I'm going to a Roger Moore movie. And yeah, you're foolishly incorrect. The proper order for James Bond is James Bond Jr., then Timothy Dalton. which is actually how I was exposed to it. I was a fucking kid. So like the first James Bond I actually watched technically was the James Bond Jr. cartoon.
Bond. James Bond Jr. No one can stop him, but scum always tries. Young Bond cuts through each web of spies. He learned the game from his uncle James. Now he's heir to the name James Bond. Bond. James Bond Jr. Look out, he's coming through. He's got a job to do while he rescues the girl. James Bond Jr. chases scum around the world.
Saw the James Bond cartoon, so I'm in this weird position of I like half pity you for starting there, but I'm half jealous that you got to see it.
Yeah, and it's like a Street Sharks / Toxic Avenger era cartoon. Yeah. Oh, so Jesus. like Jaws is in it, but he's an 80s yeah. Cartoon toy version of himself. Dr. No's in it, and it is not appropriate. He's looking like the fucking Mandarin from the comics.
Oh god, I was literally just about to ask, did they full on Fu Manchu him?
Like, do you remember how the Mandarin looked in the 90s Iron Man cartoon?
Oh no!
Yeah, kind of along that line.
Oh! Mm. Oh, dear God.
Yeah, even Fu Manchu's like, that's a little embarrassing.
Yeah, that's not okay.
But yeah, okay. No, we gotta focus on this film, because that is the nature, I feel, of this film, is that there's a lot of really interesting elements that you want to explore. And instead it's like, no, we're watching Bloodsport. And I'm like, but I want to stay in New York in the 20s and like see where this fucking gang of street urchins led by a 20-year-old go. Because I know history and I know that that actually means organized crime. I want that story. No, that's too interesting a story. We have to go to Mutai Island.
Oh, yeah. And of course, This is not just organized crime. This is cinematic organized crime filmed in the 90s. So you needed one of the Mandalores. And, of course, there's no way that this movie had the budget for Costas Mandalore. So in comes his, I believe, brother, Luis.
Yeah, for like 40 seconds of screen time?
Give or take. Like, he's, for comparison's sake, in terms of actor brothers, he's, I think back then anyway, he would have been roughly Stephen Baldwin?
Yes, that's it. That seems about right. That seems accurate. And like, no slight on him. He does great work in this, but
oh yeah.
Again, in the same, this is a reoccurring problem with this movie. And I enjoyed the fuck out of this film because I didn't know what the fuck it's like trying to do. And it's like, all right, what's going on here? What's going on?
Yeah,
I'm enjoying myself in spite of myself and I'm confused. His character has backstory with Jean-Claude Van Damme's character. And like his gang of urchins, and like he clearly runs a bit of the neighborhood, and it's just, there is an interesting story right here. You have villain who is immediately understandable and interesting against, like, ooh, I wonder, Jean-Claude Van Damme versus like 20s era gangsters. This could be cool.
Oh, absolutely.
No, we're done with that shit. We're done with that shit immediately. And it's like, this movie could be 3 to 5 fucking films covering the same amount of time. And I think it would have actually been amazing. There's a fucking Zeppelin in this film. And it's just kind of like, you know, there are goddamn, like, okay. The movie starts in 1925, but like, yeah. It a couple of years pass while he's training. So it's the 30s, right? So those fucking Germans who showed up in a Zeppelin are Nazis. They're very likely Nazis. Where the fuck is the scene with Jean-Claude Van Damme kicking the shit out of some Nazis? No! Roger Moore steals a Zeppelin. And it's a minor plot point that gets essentially swept under the rug. It is a matter of logistics.
Oh, it's not just a minor plot point. It is the single dumbest plan any of the characters enact at any point in the movie.
I need a count on Bond actors flying Nazi airships, because between this and Timothy Dalton in The Rocketeer, fuck.
I think the only saving grace with everything around that Zeppelin is the fact that you are so distracted by how poorly put together that Zeppelin looks as a prop.
It's a fucking fridge box attached to the bottom of a balloon. How the fuck does, like, a couple of guys get out of that, and it's like, what is this clown car shit?
Yeah, you look at the cabin on every exterior shot of that Zeppelin, and it's like, how does that hold more than one person, and how is that entire cabin not obviously made of plywood?
If this movie had just a little bit more time, there will be a moment when, like, they get invited inside it, and it's the fucking inside of the Zeppelin from fucking Last Crusade, with a full, like, dining room and, like area for a grand piano and dancing. And there's, like, 30 fucking people in it. The whole time. The whole time. They're not even coming out. They're just like, no, nah, whatever. Listen, this is a layover for me. I'm waiting for the next flight. Okay. No. It happened again. We're off track.
I'm sorry, but that Zeppelin deserves it.
Yeah, it deserves it. The Nazis deserve every kick that they get in their face. He somehow... Okay. He ends up on a boat.
Well, actually, I did want to mention one thing, because there, with the New York segment, there's almost a trend of some sort in movies that were made during the mid-90s, but set in the 30s, because... Mm-hmm. When we did our review for The Shadow, filmed in roughly the same time period, set in roughly the same time period, and you brought up in that review how the opening act of the movie does not tie into anything that comes later.
Mm-hmm.
That was the thought that I had here.
Yeah, but at least that one's kind of like generally explaining a backstory.
You could
have woken up like this movie could have started with him being discovered on the boat, and it's just a stowaway. What do we do with stowaways? And you could just start from there. It's like, you don't need the aristocratic history. You don't need the clown face. You don't need the newsies. I am happy that it's there because it's a bizarre entree, but
yeah,
what is that? Why are we not, why didn't we get that movie? And then as a sequel, he ends up getting kidnapped and shanghaied.
I love that you said bizarre entree, because there's so many instances here where I kept thinking, this is just something Jean-Claude Van Damme has always wanted to do, but he's never going to get the opportunity to do it unless he writes it into a film himself.
Yes, this is Jean-Claude Van Damme's Citizen Kane, and I mean that.
Oh, no, 100%. Because that opening in New York, this, if they had tied back to that in some way, there's so much in this movie that would have worked better. But as is, this feels like Van Damme just went, I have always wanted to do Oliver Twist.
Yeah.
I ain't never going to get a chance otherwise.
I've always wanted to make a 20s gangster movie. I'm never going to get a chance to do it otherwise.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a whole fuck ton. This is essentially all of the historical films set in the roughly 1880s to 1930s, made in the 90s, because, yeah, as you say, it was a thing, especially in the early 90s, because around the early 90s, people who were in their 20s and 30s, and of course the 20s and 30s, would be, like, you know, at the peak of their careers and lives and such, they would be old. They would be like dying off. They would be the ones who are the grandparents. It would be a natural narrative setup to have them be the storytellers at this point. And so all of the stories end up having like aspects of like noir and pulp. A lot of noir and pulp, because it's all hearkening back to that form of storytelling and revisiting those generations in their last like hurrah. It's why if you look at the late 90s and into the early 2000s, you see a lot more like World War II war films. And then 50s and 60s, it's a cycle. And I personally love the late 80s, early 90s, 1920s, 30s cycle. There's something about it that like, it's really fascinating that all the costumes and sets were available for this movie to use in a blink and you miss it segment. And yet they would have been incredibly expensive in any other time period.
Just to add to your thought, I would like to also note that I have seen The Shadow enough times to be able to say this with a fair amount of certainty. Hollywood only had one backdrop for 1920s, 1930s New York. One.
Yes, and that's not even like too much of a stretch or a joke. It's a set. I believe it's been destroyed now, unfortunately. But it was an actual set at, I think, Universal. I know it was in Burbank somewhere. And
yeah,
you can tell that it's that specific fucking set, because the corners are all rounded. And there aren't rounded corners in New York. It's a grid. So you can always tell if something in quote-unquote New York was shot on that set, that very specific set, if you see the rounded corners.
Yeah, with and also with the transition from the martial arts Oliver Twist we almost had to the stowaway on the gun with the gun runners. I have a question, and I kept wondering this every time I watched the movie. How long was Van Damme's Chris Dubois unconscious in that cargo hold?
Like, over a month. Because they... Okay, so... So, that boat would have to... I'm presuming that either... They wouldn't have paid for the Panama Canal, or maybe the timing doesn't work out. I can't quite remember. I believe that the Panama Canal by now existed, but... They probably, being gun runners trying to, you know, avoid attention, they would have had to sail all the way down South America to enter the Pacific. They then would have had to sail across the Pacific. And this is the quick way, but there's also a quote-unquote faster way following currents where you go across the Atlantic, down and around Africa, down and around India, loop around fucking Indonesia, and then come up to China. Regardless, over a month.
Yeah.
Over a month. Yeah. At best. In the best conditions. And they, A, never found him. B, he didn't wake up.
No, like, he's clearly... When he pokes his head out of the cargo hold, he's clearly doing it for the first time because he has no idea where he is. That boat is nowhere near New York anymore. And it's like, okay, so y'all are illegal gun runners. And not one person on this entire boat that I'm pretty sure is actually like 90% cargo hold has checked on the cargo in any way.
In any way whatsoever to notice the sweaty guy laying on top of, I think, a bag of rice.
A bag of rice,
sure.
that was concealing rifles.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like, okay, this is itchy. But because of the nature of this film, you don't have time to ruminate on it. Like, again, the first 5 minutes of this film are a separate movie from the next 5 minutes, which are a separate movie. And then just as you're like, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense, it moves into the next separate movie where we get Roger Moore and his lackey playing. I don't even know how to explain this character. He's not good. He's not bad. He shouldn't be in this movie because he's too complicated morally a character. He should be bad. He should be, again, I'm coming back to it. He should be Timothy Dalton in Hot Fuzz. At the end, he needs to be revealed to be a complete fucking asshole. But by the end of it, like, the last line of this movie is, oh yeah, and like, the guy who kidnapped me, we became friends, and I'm pretty sure he opened a trading post in the Amazon.
Yeah.
Anyway. And it's like, what the fuck?
Well, I mean, number one, this is Roger Moore playing Roger Moore. Let's be very clear.
Yes. Yes, he is. He's a little bit of a scoundrel, tiny bit of scoundrelity, but also, like, I don't know. It's so weird because you're like, no, this guy's obviously, he's a fraud. He's playing the whole British aristocratic angle. But then he comes through sometimes. And you're like, whoo. What is happening? I want a movie about Roger Moore's character.
Oh, totally.
I want his shenanigans. why is this movie constantly trying to get me to pay attention to other things that don't exist?
Yeah, and first and foremost, if you told me that Lord Edgar Dobbs was Jack Sparrow's, like, I don't know, great-grandson, give or take?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry, that would kind of work.
Yeah, he's a fantastic, like, British swindler. It's a lesser-known architect, but I guess technically, no, it comes back to, like, Fagin. You know, from Oliver Twist,
yeah.
Where it's like, he puts on a lot of airs, is in conversation, erudite, and like calm and like emotionally stable, but is a complete fucking career criminal bastard until he has like an attack of empathy randomly and will become your friend. While still being a bastard. It's, what is happening?
Yeah.
I understand if Roger Moore's natural charisma scuttled the script.
Which it probably did.
But at that point, yeah, likely. But at that point, right around it. Roll with it more. More.
Well, now, to that, what I would suggest is that, again, I would take this opportunity to remind you that this is a story by Frank Dukes and Jean-Claude Van Damme.
I know, and that's the thing that breaks me so much about it, is it has so many compelling storytelling elements that are more complicated than it has any credit, but it doesn't follow through with it at all. And so it's just this thing of like, how is this movie so interesting? It's written by Jean-Claude Van Damme. Why does this movie fail in all of its interesting aspects? Oh, right. Because it's written by Jean-Claude Van Damme. It's bizarre. This movie is the equivalent of the first time someone put hot fudge on ice cream and people are like, that's hot on cold. It doesn't work.
This movie is a 14-year-old's really well done creative writing assignment.
Yeah, it's still a 14-year-old's writing assignment, and so there are holes and issues.
Oh, yeah.
But you can be like, this kid needs to be put in a program.
Yep.
Because there's potential here.
Exactly.
So he meets Roger Moore and Roger Moore's compatriot, and they're off on their own little like swindle adventure, and they are chasing a MacGuffin of a MacGuffin. They're looking for a map on an invitation to a secret fight thing.
Oh no! Because you're skipping over part.
Oh, good.
Because that's not what they're doing when they meet Dubois.
Oh, you.
Now, remember, first, they save him from the gunrunners so that Lord Dobbs can sell him into slavery on Muay Thai Island.
Yeah. Which is like, just, okay. That's its own fucking film. That is its own film, once again, of like this, you know, a fake aristocrat swindler screwing over some pie-eyed kid. They keep calling him kid. He was 36 when they recorded this movie, and his character is 25. And yet, constantly, they refer to him as kid. I was so certain when, like, especially after the first couple of scenes, that we would learn that he was supposed to be like 15.
And the only way that I can get that to even close to work is the simple fact that Van Damme's method of character acting in much of this portion of the movie is to look mildly worried about everything at all times.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like going somewhere where you don't speak any of the language. Even if you're perfectly fine, you still have this look of like, I don't know what's happening. I don't know what's happening. I don't know if this is good or bad. And he has that right up until he gets sold into slavery, fight slavery. And the movie jumps ahead another movie, a fascinating fucking film in which he is taken off by this like fight cult and taught how to fight, you know, like professionally, perfectly at this like level of almost the chosen one. And then
remember, it's a Bloodsport clone. Muay Thai had to come in.
And that's fine. Why is all of this happening like off screen or not the focus of its own film? Because next time we meet these people, we meet Snooty Snoot, British fake fraud, via a journalist from New York whose dad owns the paper.
Yep.
Neat. And I'm just trying to, at this point, they're chasing the MacGuffin, right?
No.
Like he's heard of MacGuffin? Where the fuck?
Okay.
This film's a patchwork.
I got you.
The bleed.
I got you. So.
Hit me.
Dobbs and Harry Smythe with an I, unless you're looking at his IMDb where it's suddenly a Y.
Yeah. And that's a very, very distinct thing of like, but they say it's with an I. What the fuck?
Yeah.
Or was that some bullshit fraud so that they spell his name wrong in the movie and we can never charge him? you got the wrong person, officers. I'm Smythe with a Y. That's clearly Smythe with an I because he made a fucking point of it.
Now, since the movie doesn't bother to establish this, I feel like we can safely say that the answer to your question is yes. Moving on.
Sure.
So they meet up with the journalist Carrie Newton in this kind of sort of high class, almost a cafe, and Lord Dobbs bets Smith that he can successfully hit on her.
Yeah.
I would like to note that this is the same Roger Moore who had already left the Bond franchise because he felt that he was far too old to be doing exactly this.
I think that by making his character a scoundrel in this, he would have been okay with it. Like,
potentially.
As opposed to Bond is a protagonist, you know, like those are love interests. This is not a matter of love interest. This is a scoundrel doing something scoundrelous. Scoundrelness? Scoundrelly. Anyway, he's being a fucking creep.
Yeah. And so they start showing her around Tibet, and she's ostensibly looking for this big story, you know, ignoring the fact that she's there because daddy wanted to get her the hell away from him.
Yeah.
And they take her to a Muay Thai fight where she's like oddly enjoying the violence and is like, yes, this is my story. This is what I want to cover. And then a new fighter comes out to the ring. And guess who?
Yay. And once again, to point out, her character has such...
I am not quite done.
Oh, okay.
Because remember.
Yeah, you continue.
Dobbs spots Dubois coming out for Dubois' fight, recognizes him.
Yeah.
And is basically, oh shit, we got to go. So he grabs Smith and is like, yeah, we're just going to sneak out the back door so that Chris does not see us. As soon as they get to the hallway to the back door, Chris immediately steps into frame to cut them off.
Yeah.
And Dubois is like, listen, I know what you did. You owe me I want to find a way to this tournament so that we can steal this giant gold dragon.
Right. Yes. Okay. So yeah, he. See, again, so that's two more.
Yep.
This is five films so far that this thing has generated, because one, we need to see the reporter's backstory, because getting kicked out of New York and high society to come have to like report on stuff in the Far East in the 20s and 30s. That's a fucking interesting story. Her interest already in fucking Mortal Kombat. That's show us that that's a separate fucking film, a character study on this person. Next, we get to, yeah, like Chris has gone through his own like hero's journey of a sort, and he's buff as fuck. He is now like confident. He's pissed. He's got a good reason, but more importantly, he has a separate agenda.
Yep.
To chase this gold dragon. It's like, you could have had all of that. You could have made a movie about a guy who gets sold into fight slavery and finds his way through being like the best fighter and chasing this legendary fortune in this legendary fight. And it's like, that's five films before we have really gotten to the fucking plot of this one.
And also, you remember how early on Chris's goal was to get back to New York so he could get back to his kids?
The kids, yeah.
Fuck them kids.
Oh, yeah, them kids is fucking old, dead, running their own gang, incarcerated, joined the cops. They're so... Those... I love by the end of it, he's like, I took care of the kids. And it's like, listen, man, unless you killed them, you weren't doing shit. They probably forgot about you.
Yeah, he came back with no prize money at all, but still somehow got all of those kids off the streets.
I just want there to be like two newsies standing on a corner. It's like, holy shit, it's the clown. What? Oh my God, he's jacked!
Oh, that would be amazing.
And like, that's another fucking film. He goes back to New York and beats the fuck out of the mob.
Yeah. I mean, we have described all this. And as you've said, we've hit five potential films here. We still have another character to introduce.
Right? What if this whole fucking film had been like a setup? Like, so the book ending, the in the bar. What if he had actually at that point been an old mob boss who could still beat the fuck out of people?
Yes.
And like no yes. one knows that he's actually super dangerous and super powerful. And at the very end, it's like, I have but this bar, or this is my bar. This is a mob bar. This is like the what's his last name again?
Dubois.
This is a Dubois family bar. Yes, I know. I am Dubois.
Yes!
And, like, that's it. And it's been, like, the building of this whole fucking empire in the background. Nah. So, six films to get to this point. In this one film, there's another fucking film to be had, of course, in the backstory of the other character you just mentioned.
Because we have only gotten to the part where their scheme starts. So now, we've seen the Mortal Kombat-esque delivery of the invitations to the Kumite. I mean, Gang Ging. Totally not the same thing, I swear.
Not the same. See, they're different words in different languages. That it means the same thing is irregardless.
But now in comes James Remar as Apollo Creed. I mean, Maxie Divine.
Great name, which again, the character enters with like a legend. People know who he is. He's the world heavyweight boxing champion. And he's played by a great actor who's doing great work. Where the fuck is the seventh movie? which leads into the eighth movie, which is just them being like, wait a minute, we can set up Maxie Divine, but then sucker him out and put Belgium Boy in. That's a different movie.
And I would also, in terms of Real Geeks history, I would like to note that we've talked about the idea of multiple potential movies in whatever movie we happen to be reviewing before.
Yeah.
I think we're one more movie and we break the record.
Yes, I truly believe so. And that one movie is the backstory to the fucking scrolls, the golden thing. There is so much work being put into background that is just never explored. Fuck.
Yeah,
like, and there's still more. There's still more that will spin out. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just saying, it was like, I don't think we've ever gone higher than eight movies with this train of thought.
Yeah, but that's eight. What was Lord What's-His-Name and his friend doing between when they enslaved and re-met Chris? At the very end of the film, spoiler alert, Chris is just like, yeah, they set up a trade post in the Amazon, God rest their souls. It's like, the fuck does that mean? Show me what that means. I want that story.
Yeah.
That's nine.
And I love it, like, Carrie Newton, the journalist.
Yeah.
A lot of the middle of this movie is used to tease a love story between her and Chris. I believe that's number 10 because of how quickly that gets dropped.
Yeah, that would be its own thing, completely separate about like this film almost feels like it's Jean-Claude Van Damme trying to convince my mom to watch this movie, because like there's a way to cut the trailer for this so that you don't see any fighting and it's just like period piece and romance and a little bit of scoundrel. That's it. There is such an easy way to do that. And that would be that part of the film.
Now,
expat meets a former slave in the Far East.
I will go you in terms of hypothetical trailers. I feel like I might be able to go you one better here, because you know how with a lot of modern day trailers, they'll sell a movie as if it's in a genre that it's actually like nowhere near.
Indeed.
I submit that there is no genre that you could not cut a trailer for this movie for where it could not
work. Even time travel. You're right.
I am telling you, I am convinced. I am convinced that between what we actually see in the movie and what's probably on the proverbial cutting room floor that still would have potentially gone into a trailer, you could cut this as Van Damme's first romantic comedy.
Oh, easily. Easily. So goddamn easily. Like, terrifyingly easily. This can be definitely cut as, like, yeah, anything shy of like a spacefaring sci-fi. it even has like some steam and diesel punk elements if you like really strain.
Yeah.
Definitely a lot of pulp. So then we get another film. This is film 10 or 11 in which they are trying to sucker Maxie out of the scroll, which is a journey. Like, they're literally journeying. That is often its own story, the journey.
Yep.
No, here it's like 10 minutes in this movie. It's just 10 minutes. And he has a whole like mini character arc with, and like mini conflict with Jean-Claude Van Damme that gets solved. Why does it get solved? because the movie needs it to be.
But, yeah, exactly. And I would also like to know that that 10 minutes is 10 minutes of journey footage where Lord Dobbs is magically able to get them whatever form of transportation they need to cover every journey film trope you can think of.
Yeah, which again, like, raises so many questions about this character. He's not a complete fraud. He has money and means. Is he a lord? I don't know. Probably not. Maybe. Fuck! He's so inconsistent within a consistent framework. Then we get to, like, films 12 through 20, when we're introduced to all of the other fighters who are all interesting or have, like, they have backstories that are alluded to. I loved Japan versus Okinawa.
Thank you!
Okinawa in Japan. And it's like, no, you have to understand, at this time, no, there was a fucking war!
Yeah, because
that's its own fucking story!
I having had no idea. God, I'm jumping around so much, my Apple Watch honestly thought that I had fallen. But yeah, like, where I had no idea of any sort of war in Japan during this time period, I'm sitting there going, is this somehow the equivalent of if Canada and Newfoundland had both sent fighters to this tournament?
Right? And so, you know, you get Japan versus Okinawa, but later on, you get one guy, one Zulu, representing all of Africa. And it's not from Zululand. No, it's from Africa. So this one guy represents Okinawa versus Japan, but this one guy represents all of Africa. It's like, what is this film doing? Why?
For me, as the casual viewer, I'm sitting there going, you have two representatives from Japan for some reason.
And a sumo.
Oh, we're going to get to the sumo because I have things to say. But America could not have been both represented by Maxie and Chris? Was there not a way for Chris to earn his way in?
And I completely understand, like, the, you know, like, what they were trying to make a historical point at the time, but there are so many ways they could have gone. Chris could have been like, I was not actually born in America. And it would have been like, okay, fine, fuck it. We don't have a Belgian guy. Here, fight the Scot. Yeah, the Mongolian, fascinating, great character who they don't give anything to at all.
They don't give him so much as a line, and yet Chris is Hulk Hogan in No Holds Barred levels of scared of this man.
Yeah, and like, this guy has the most visually distinct look. He's clearly supposed to be the in-fight nemesis. Like, this is the big guy you gotta beat. He's your rival. Not a single line, no real backstory, nope. Looks like a G.I. Joe character. Can't stop fucking looking at him when he's on screen. Riveted. What the fuck is this film?
Well, and another reason that I wanted Maxie in the tournament, because, to be perfectly frank, I made the Apollo Creed joke earlier because Maxie needed to die.
Yeah, Maxie definitely needed to die, and like, for the passing of the belt to be through that would have meant, like, the fights actually would have meant something. Aside from at the very end, when suddenly they're like, ah, fuck it, we need to have emotional weight to this. We'll kill him if not. It's like, okay, I kind of like that approach of like, well, okay, you can sub in. But if he loses, you're stuck here forever. And then, okay, we'll let you fight, but if you lose, we're gonna kill the prisoners. It's like, that's interesting. That's cool. Okay, cool.
Yeah,
motivation.
Yeah.
Awesome. Because we've gotten so far in this film without any.
Oh boy, have we. Because the other Muay Thai fighter and his trainer, Cao, who was essentially the top supporting actor of, if I've got my numbers right, I think movie number 7? the quest is so crazy that I'm sitting here having to do math.
Yeah, I want all of them to be on the quest, and they all have their own individual, like, full-on fucking, like, Soul Calibur levels of background for every character, please. And when you say the other Muay Thai fighter, I would like to point out that aside from the Brazilian and the sumo wrestler, they're all Muay Thai fighters. The Scots, for some reason, the guy from Spain, yep, he's fighting Muay Thai, but every now and then he goes, olé!
Well, I feel like there is one exception, one potential exception to
you're
that.
You're right, the Russian.
I was gonna say the Japanese fat joke. I mean, sumo wrestler.
Yeah, well.
Because, oh, God. The fat shaming that the sound department was doing on this movie.
Yeah, no, like.
Jesus.
You definitely get a feeling of, like, Jean-Claude Van Damme does not appreciate sumo as a martial art.
No. But yeah, like the other Muay Thai fighter that Dubois was, I guess, friends with.
Another film, another film. Their little adventures through the Muay Thai cult. Fuck it. You betrayed us.
I swear to God, I actually just heard our other film counter, the device that I've just made up in my head right now, actually threw up a stack of papers and went, I quit.
Yeah. I think we're on film 21, maybe 22.
At least, Jesus, but like that other Muay Thai fighter, the one the Mongolian warrior kills, that should have been Maxie Divine, number one.
Yeah.
Number two, Aki Aliong, the actor who played Cao. Sir, I say this to you with the utmost respect. This movie needed James Hong so badly.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, it did. Yes. Yes.
I mean, okay, yes. Every film in existence needs James Hong. But this in particular.
You know what this film needed? It needed Christopher Walken from Balls of Fury. Have you ever seen that? It's
I have not.
It's the Kumitai or Death Fight, Death whatever, cliche, but instead of fighting, they're playing like table tennis, and he's dressed like Fu Manchu.
I should be commenting about how offensive that is, but I'm sitting here going, yeah, that sounds like Christopher Walken role. He would so do that.
Yeah, and like there's a high priest in the background of most of the shots, and it's just, what if for some fucking reason they actually cast an actor, like a recognizable actor in that? And the guy didn't have any lines or anything. Like, it's another movie. Who the fuck's that guy? Oh, we haven't even gotten to that guy yet. He's the guardian of the dragon. You have to beat him at the end of it. Oh, fuck. Really? He looks 80.
Yes.
Just you wait. Fucking rips his gi off and he's like jacked like the grandpa from fucking Dragon Ball Z.
Oh, and another thing, and yeah, at this point, I think we're at a movie like 150.
Yeah.
But the fight scenes for the tournament. How is it that your director is Jean-Claude Van Damme? Nobody else has a fight that lasts longer than 30 seconds, and God forbid anyone blocks anything.
Yeah, it's...
And I feel like I may have answered my own question when I said director Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Yeah, all the shots on me, thank you very much. Look how awesome I am. You get a couple of little bits to show, like, okay, that's how that fight went. Okay, that's how that fight went. Okay, that's how that fight went. That's all you need.
Yeah, like, there was... In particular, the fight between Chris and the Chinese tiger style fighter.
Yeah.
Visually, they worked together so well.
Yeah. No, like they...
At no point is that taken advantage of.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with anything. Nothing to do with. I loved when Lord What's-His-Nut and his friend are just sitting there watching. It's like, he's like an animal. He's kind of like a snake. And it's like, you motherfuckers. There's another movie where these two fucking schmucks go and, like, steal Kung Fu and bring it back to, like America. And are like, yes, in this handy-dandy pamphlet, which we learned from the ancient masters.
Okay. Now, a slight correction, that was not Dobbs and Smith.
Oh, you're right.
Those lines were Maxie's.
Yeah, which again...
Lines were Maxie's.
How the fuck does he not Carrie know about
Kung Fu? And Carrie was making that pamphlet.
So bad. Fucking hell.
But all that said, you are right in that it should have been those two.
Yeah, just being like, oh my, oh my, oh my, oh my.
Like, what... When James Remar, who, as you said earlier, wonderful actor, out of respect for the man's performance, why is he being given lines that are solely there for an audience info dump? Because apparently anyone watching this movie is an idiot.
Yeah, he should have been the one... replying. They should ask the stupid questions and he should be like explaining it and like explaining it in terms they don't even understand. He should immediately leap into like, that's Crane style of the blah 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 of Kung Fu, and they're like, what? Sure, yes. Blue Fu, Kung Fu, what? You know, like there's characters set up and dialogue that should follow. And because, again, this film was written by Jean-Claude Van Damme, it doesn't.
Yeah, like, you don't even have to make the explanations all that complicated because he's, you know, heavyweight champion of the world of boxing, so probably not super familiar with Kung Fu. Like, he flat out said, Chris, you beat me because you are fast and used kicks.
Yeah.
So.
And like, I...
Okay.
But he also has the fucking scroll.
Yeah, and like actual conversation instead of him just saying it to the camera. That is all I'm asking for.
Yeah, exactly. So the Mongolian fighter who his name is Mongolian, apparently. I don't know if they ever gave a proper name. They just keep calling him the Mongolian, you know, because he's from Mongolia. Yeah.
He's credited on IMDb as Khan brackets Mongolian fighter.
Cool. Doesn't look and, Mongolian, but okay.
Oh, no, he. Okay. Speaking of trends in 90s film, you ever notice how any particularly 90s film that has a large amount of Asian actors, there's always that one actor who is there because the casting director clearly ran out of Asian actors to call or could not find an Asian actor to fit the bill that they were looking for.
Yeah.
It's this guy.
Yeah, it's definitely this guy, because, like, you know, now you there are Mongolian actors that you can call upon. I could see in 1996 it being like, what? No. What? Who? No. You know, like, you wouldn't be lucky enough to get, like, an actor who is Mongolian and has fight experience. So you go fight experience first, quote unquote, exoticism second. And by exoticism, essentially just kind of dress him sort of like Arabian Klingon.
And y'all, if you don't believe me, watch clips from this movie and then watch clips from The Shadow, because you're going to see the same goddamn thing, to the point that I'm not convinced that it is not the same dude in both movies.
Yeah, it's not good. It's best forgotten. Best left in the fucking past. But he beats the fuck out of everyone, and our two fraudsters go, holy shit, Chris isn't gonna win. We should just steal the gold. Let's just steal the gold. It should have been the plot to start with. Let's just steal the gold while everyone's watching the fight. Movie didn't know apparently that was gonna be a plot point until we reached it. Again, separate movies. These two idiots going around the world trying to steal relics is its own film series.
Oh, it totally is. And the way that they do it here is so loud and so attention grabbing that John Matrix is looking straight outside of the frame, straight from Commando, looking over at this movie and going, yeah, that's well done, the stealth plot, yes.
Yes, well done, yeah. Like, this is, in terms of stealthy, you're really, really doing a lot of work to make, this movie's doing a lot of work to make Solid Snake look like a brilliant stealth genius sitting there under his cardboard box. Because, yeah, that's fucking,
oh my God, it's never.
One, that's quiet. Two, it's just a box. It's not stealing a Zeppelin. and just being like, okay, grab the gold and attach it to the cap. It's like, people can hear you. They might notice that the Zeppelin is now overhead and there's an Englishman yelling at the side of it.
And also, in terms of this episode of our podcast, I would like to note the fact that we have now done something this movie refused to do, because we did not get sidetracked with the Zeppelin earlier, because we have now come back around to it.
Yeah, see, the Zeppelin just goes around and around, and then eventually... hold on. Why is there a German Zeppelin in this film and it doesn't burst into flame? Fuck you.
I mean, okay, yes, they did bring it down by puncturing it with arrows. However, I feel like the second the Zeppelin would hit the ground, your question is still valid.
There's all, like, okay, you're hitting it with arrows. Cool. For arrows to puncture the side of a Zeppelin, it would have to have a flint or steel, like, iron tip on it. That friction would eventually, like, there's a high chance that the friction of it and the puncture would create enough sparks to ignite the Zeppelin. Which, again, this is a German Zeppelin in the 1930s.
Yeah.
It is, as a historical fact, filled with hydrogen. And this movie went, no, that's too cool. We're not doing that.
Well, that, and let's be honest, this particular Zeppelin, I'm sorry, that thing looked like it was filled with air at the nearest convenience store about 20 minutes before it arrived.
That's the Zeppelin they let Hitler ride around in the backyard. And it's like tied down to a little rail track. And it's like, he's fine. He can't go anywhere. He's fine. I am having so much fun!
Like, folks, she says that as a joke. But when you see this thing on screen, like just the scale of it, that is exactly what it looks like.
Yeah, it's a hobby zeppelin. It's a hobby zeppelin. Anyway, they get caught.
That zeppelin is the 1930s equivalent of a Power Wheels Jeep.
Oh my God, it is too. It is too. Oh my God.
Like, I swear to God, we could do a separate bonus episode just the Zeppelin jokes.
Just fuck. Oh my God. It's like a fucking clubhouse, like someone built in a tree in their backyard. It's the Red Ryder BB gun of Zeppelins.
Oh, that makes the ladder Hobbs throws down so much better.
I'm pretty sure the Easy Bake Oven is more dangerous than the Zeppelin, because that thing will actually fucking burn you. Anyway, yeah, the plot doesn't work. They get discovered in this very obvious attempt at last-ditch theft, and instead of just killing them for some reason, you know, it would have been super easy to, like, one, make them villains at this point, actual full-on villains.
Yep.
Two, write them out of the fucking script, because the movie's kind of done with them, and it's entering its third act final fight, which the tension should be between, like, our main character, Jean-Claude Van Damme, and his fight nemesis. And whoever backs up his fight nemesis. Now, no one backs up his fight nemesis. That should have been the English guy. He should have, like, switched and be like, oh, yeah, well, I noticed that you're getting your ass kicked.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've decided to get behind, yo, this guy. Like, this is a film that I'm watching it the whole time. I'm like, what this movie needs, above all, is a pro wrestling writer to give it a pass. And just be like, no, we can punch that up.
Yes.
No, we can punch that up. No, these two should be against each other.
Mid-90s Paul Heyman, where were you when we needed you?
Seriously, like the whole time I'm looking at Roger Moore, and it's like, you would have been a great wrestling manager. Like, just sleazy son of a bitch. And his character would make sense that way. The on-again, off-again antagonistic slash charmingness, that would make sense. If he was an on-mic wrestling manager. And he should have played it that way. At the very least, like a little bit of Don King, you know? But instead, you get just kind of like, oh no, I've been arrested, and they say they're going to kill us if you don't win the fight. Okay, so now Jean-Claude Van Damme has reasons to win the fight, aside from he already was trying to win this golden dragon for entirely separate reasons that are not mentioned in the film. He got to the end of a fight tournament with no motivation.
Oh, no, it Dobbs does not say they're going to kill us if you don't win. They're about to execute them then and there. Dubois stops them and volunteers on the spot that if he wins the tournament, he gets their lives and instead of the golden dragon that he was there for in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. Which, like, okay, you're making your protagonist a good guy. Cool. Anyone else would have been like, ah, well, I guess you shouldn't have sold me into slavery, huh? Hmm. Nope.
Yeah.
Throw away your entire agenda.
Also, a quick side note, a bit of Roger Moore trivia. So, in 2017, there was an attempt to relaunch The Saint as a TV series. Roger Moore was cast as what was planned to be the season arcing villain.
Mm-hmm.
And so this did not get picked up, and they went to the old practice from roughly the late 70s, early 80s of taking the failed pilot and re-editing it and putting it out as a movie, which is how I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And make no mistake, Roger Moore can absolutely do a cold, calculating villain. So there wasn't a goddamn thing stopping him from switching sides and being an actual full-on villain in this movie. Aside from the phrase, written and directed by Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Yeah, exactly.
But other than that.
Because a more... see, like, to have gotten this far shows that Jean-Claude Van Damme is very talented. He does understand how to make a movie. I don't know if he's decided what movie to make yet. Even like nearing the end of this, like he wants to make all of these movies and he only has the budget to make one. And it just took a little bit of commitment. And that would have making Roger Moore the de facto villain of this would have just brought everything together. You didn't need it to be a grand scheme. He can be reactionary to all this, but it would at least give some solid fucking ground for Jean-Claude Van Damme to have, like, some motivation. Aside from, like, oh, you killed my friend who we had 20 seconds of screen time with?
Yeah, give or take.
Again, should have been Maxi. Wasn't. Yeah, but fuck it, who cares? It's... the move, yeah, it's a decent fight scene at the end. You know, again, the Mongolian should have had, like, Khan should have had more character, more menace, more something. I don't even know if his character is aware that, like, there's any drama going on outside. Like, it feels like this guy goes to his dressing room between fights and is totally unaware of anything occurring on any other level with any other people. It's just, I'm here to work. I don't care. I don't care about your drama. I don't care about whatever. I am here to collect a paycheck. And if I win or lose, it doesn't matter. I still get paid.
Oh, yeah. And remember, though, the only previous interaction between the Mongoli fighter and our main characters, like, before the tournament starts, was that scene in the dining hall where he's doing the standard bullying. He says to Maxi, you're in my seat. A fight almost breaks out, but the Mongolian warrior smashes the table in half. So he loses the seat that he was arguing over.
Yeah.
And then leaves.
Yeah, and that's the extent of his character. That doesn't tell us anything except that he's indecisive and violent. And it's like the second half of that is good, but the indecision, this is supposed to be our one of our villains. And by the end of it, it's kind of like he got a second, like a follow up prize, right? Like he got second place. Yeah. Okay, good. I just didn't want him to like be left. Like, it's so fucking weird. No one is a villain in this film that cries for a fucking villain. You have Nazis in it and they're not the villain. You have an aristocratic fucking slaver and he's not the villain because he's friends with them at the end. You have the Mongolian who's just kind of like, he's more an obstacle and not even to like any plot point necessarily. There are a thousand ways that the plot could have been resolved without having to go through him. That's how disconnected the elements of this film are.
This is like Van Damme's writing was, and again, I love how every time I bring up something that confused me or I need explanation and my brain immediately goes written and directed by Jean-Claude Van Damme. Like, I'm pretty sure written and directed by Jean-Claude Van Damme should be the actual title of this episode.
Honestly, obviously, at some point we'll have to watch JCVD because eventually figure this out. He gets it. He gets the whole fucking point. He gets the appeal. He finally gets his head around the whole thing and he figures out how to make the movie he wants to make. It's really entertaining. Give it a shot. At some point, we'll come around to it. But this film is not there yet. and it's majestic for it.
Yeah, like he's, if you think about it, he's pretty clearly lifting characters and plot points and so forth from other films that have done this more successfully.
Hell, the
including his own, because this is remake number 8 of Bloodsport.
One of the reoccurring songs in this movie is just "Look Down" from Les Mis, without lyrics. That's it. It's just the audio track from na 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 na. That's it. It's fucking Les Mis, and you just know because of the timing. He like heard that at some point and was like, "I likes that we got to have that in the movie."
Yeah. Like I could totally believe that, because there are points where the score is oddly dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
For the scene in question.
Yeah.
And also with our Mongolian warrior, are you honestly going to tell me that the Mongolian warrior is not Dolph Lundgren from Rocky IV?
Yeah, exactly. But like, Ivan had a lot of character and menace behind that. Like, that's what we needed. There needed to be menace. And there's like, he has some presence, but he doesn't have actual menace. It's, and yeah, he should have killed Maxie. That would have done it. Yeah, it would have been an obvious ripoff of Rocky IV, but I'm sorry that I demand an obvious ripoff of Rocky IV in your obvious ripoff of Bloodsport 11. Anyway, Jean-Claude Van Damme wins. He saves the life of his friends. I like how it's like the magical, prize, the gold dragon, remains in Tibet, and like, it's like, okay, but this is a tournament that occurs every couple of years, say once a decade, let's say that.
Yeah.
Why is this gold dragon still there? What, I demand the storyline of every one of these fights, in which at the very last fight something occurs where the fighter switches up and is like, "No, I no longer want the gold dragon. I need this." And it has occurred for 800 years.
Okay. As long as we're going to rip off stuff from other movies, how about this? Khan, that Mongolian warrior, is secretly immortal, and he's basically Goro from Mortal Kombat. And no, up to Dubois, no one has ever gotten past that warrior.
Like that, that's one potential. Another would be at the very end, like the last scene of this is the monks. That like it's still set in like the 90s. It's like we go back to the bar. Jean-Claude Van Damme's an old man, and it goes to like modern Tibet, and you see the same monks. They're ageless, and they're like putting away the gold dragon again, and one just looks right at the camera and winks or something. And it's like, oh, it's actually about like hidden knowledge, and no one will ever win the dragon, because it, by the time you reach that stage, you're actually searching for your true potential, and it's some Buddhist thing. This film has such potential for so many other films. Damn it.
And again, if we couldn't have James Hong as the Muay Thai master.
Where's David Carradine? James
Hong is the guy overseeing the tournament. Yeah, how are these guys not available?
Like, what if at the you never see the Grand Master, like or Grand Priest, and at the end it's just like he takes off his mask and it's fucking Legend of Kung Fu there, and he's just like, "Wow, congratulations, my son." Such potential. What if it's Alec Baldwin and he's just like, "Now I must teach you my secrets." What if it's Billy Zane and this is how you become the Phantom?
Yes!
And it just like, well, like it pulls back a curtain.
You're doing a 90s pulp movie, Billy Zane minimum.
It pulls back a curtain, and on one side is Legend of Kung Fu Michael Keaton. On the other is Antonio Banderas' Zorro. It's just all of it. Like, you are, it is time. You can join the pantheon of 90s pulp-inspired heroes.
Where the hell is this League of Extraordinary Gentlemen?
Oh my god.
I have said it before and I will say it again. A 30s pulp-inspired League of Extraordinary Gentlemen would be fucking amazing.
It would be, and it's one of the only eras Alan Moore intentionally never touched on. He actually jumps over that era for the most part. The characters are off doing things. It's like secret shit.
Yeah.
But you get before then up to, if I recall, 1910. And then you get after then when they're describing the Big Brother regime. There's a chunk in the middle where you could absolutely do that. Absolutely. Damn it, Alan Moore.
The Shadow, The Rocketeer, Doc Savage, come on now.
Yeah, do it.
And most of them are public domain.
Most of them. Rocketeer, over the mouse's dead hand, or over the mouse's cold dead hands.
Yeah, and I know The Shadow tragically isn't.
Is, but soon, relatively.
I think he's buried somewhere in Sony's catalog.
Yeah, but like the actual like original radio and pulp versions should be coming up in the next decade.
Yeah,
so that's cool. Got that to look forward to.
Like, yes.
We're almost at the runtime of the movie, so we should probably. Wrap this up. The movie ends as stupidly and ineffectually and suddenly as anything else occurs in it, in which he just goes, anyway, we all lived happily ever after. And then it ends.
Yeah. Yeah, we get a bit of narrative with each of the characters' fates. Like, Maxie opens up a school to train fighters because... Again, Apollo Creed, like, come on.
Yeah.
Carrie writes a best-selling book about the whole adventure. That's the only reason the character is there. Like, literally, other than that, she does nothing for the plot at all.
Pretty much. And it would have been interesting if you tie it back in, like, through the Bloodsport films or whatever, and it's like... referencing, oh, I was inspired by this book. Oh, I was inspired by this book. And then you go back and this is the writing of that book. Another fucking film that could have been. No. And yeah, then we get our cryptic reference to the two criminals. And it's just like, what the fuck? Would they piss off the locals and get murdered? Did they drown in the Amazon? Like, what the fuck does that mean? What is happening?
Knowing Chris's, shall we say, particular set of skills and how his claim that he got his kids all off the street, like, there's probably a bit of murder involved.
Yeah, yeah. I just want, like, at the very end of all of that, it to flash back to the bartender. He's like, bullshit! And it cuts to black.
I mean, that would have been better than him standing there stunned, wasting an awful lot of whiskey.
Yes. So much whiskey wasted. Well, I, despite the fact that we have spent the last hour and a half more or less ripping this film to shreds, I had a really good time. This film is very watchable.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like its strength and its weakness. It demands your attention and you give it, but in doing so, you notice all of its flaws, but its momentum just keeps going.
Oh yeah. No, like, If you're a fan of 90s cinema, 90s martial arts cinema in particular, like I would say yes, definitely check out The Quest.
Mm-hmm.
I would also say that what you will experience is the equivalent of eating a really good bag of popcorn. You will enjoy yourself. You'll be satisfied by the end. You'll completely forget about the experience about a half hour later, but...
You'll also feel gassy. This movie makes me want to watch The 13th Warrior. And I'm not entirely sure why, but it really does. It makes me want to watch... At some point, we're going to get to The 13th Warrior. I fucking love The 13th Warrior. It is a pile of crap. I love it. But until then, what are we watching next week? What the hell can we follow this up with?
Keeping in mind that I am actually out of town at the end of the month. So since I won't be able to record that weekend, technically the next episode is up to you.
Ugh. I'll save The 13th Warrior because, one, I want your opinion on it. Two, I need a victim to vomit Beowulf facts on. Michael Crichton made a terrible book based on one of my favorite pieces of ancient literature? Oh, dear.
All that said, after I get back from our nation's capital, speaking of the earlier referenced piles of crap.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the last three movies on my list are there because, as far as I'm concerned, they are works of art, but Pain Before Pleasure. So we are once again going back to my childhood. To 1982 and that era of Disney films where they couldn't quite get it right. Specifically, you know the phrase something walked so something else could run?
Indeed.
We're going to be looking at the film that drunkenly stumbled forward so that the MCU could run.
Oh no.
I believe possibly Disney's first superhero film.
God have mercy on our souls.
this was my childhood superhero equivalent of Escape from Witch Mountain.
Jesus fucking Christ. Like, I've got a good excuse. Mine was Meteor Man. What the fuck is yours? Until then, if you'd like to get in touch with us and tell us what terrible secret film lurks in your origin, you can contact us at...
scrolls for fighting tournaments that we will not be entering because we don't want to die can be sent to if you're a monk who somehow has email, which amazing, and we would love to hear from you just on that basis, realgeekshfx@gmail.com or on Twitter at realgeekshfx. You can reach me specifically on Twitter, Instagram, although hopefully if it's on Instagram, you're not one of the 50,000 bots that is trying to offer me free products from Shein. As well as TikTok, Hive and Clapper whenever I bother to use those accounts.
And I can be found on Twitter at Friday in Halifax and Crash and Burn everywhere else. Kick sound. I just want to have a whoosh.
Nice.
see ya.
Bye-bye.